This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi friends, and welcome back to another episode of Open House, a fresh, fun, and real podcast where I, Louise Rumble, invite you inside the therapy room with me to learn from some of the very best psychologists, therapists, and sex and intimacy coaches that I have found. No topic is off the table, no question too juicy, and no experience too shameful. At Open House, everyone is welcome. And we're on a mission to develop a new mental health experience for all, because we believe that true happiness is coming home to yourself under the layers and layers of you that society has told you to be. As ever, please remember that this podcast is for entertainment purposes only, and you should always seek professional medical help when necessary. Now, let's get into it, and I'll see you on the other side. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Open House podcast. I am here with Dr. Laura Williams, clinical psychologist and trauma specialist. We've been talking about doing an episode for a while, and when Dr. Laura messaged me saying, I want to talk about schema chemistry with you, I was like, bingo, now is the time. This is one of the most important and fascinating things that I have ever learned about. You might be listening to this episode thinking, what is schema? I've never heard of that word before. And we will start the episode off with a very brief overview as to what that is. But what I want to say is that schema therapy changed my life. And that's why when Dr. Laura messaged me saying, should we talk about this? I was like, yes, yes, and yes. I've been waiting for the person that is the right person to do this episode with. And she's finally here. Schema therapy has been the most powerful part of my therapy journey. It is the type of therapy that I have taken the most value from. It truly connected all the dots in a way that I didn't get from other types of therapy. Not only that, but I also think that schema therapy is the kind of therapy that you can navigate on your own through books and through reading if you don't have the financial resources. It is so clear to understand. There's such clear things that you can identify with. And schema chemistry, when you learn about this, you are going to have your minds blown. You are going to be like, oh my God, I've been living my whole life running on schema chemistry. So hi, Dr. Laura, how are you today?
Hello, and thank you so much for that amazing introduction. I am super excited to be here. Schema therapy is something that I just love working with in that modality, and I know that it's going to give so much value to the listeners of your podcast. So yeah, let's do it. So a schema is essentially an unhelpful pattern in how we think and feel and behave in relation to both ourselves and others. Those patterns or maladaptive schemas develop in response to our childhood attachment relationships. They are elaborated on through our life as we have other experiences, other relationships, whether that be in our adolescence, through friendships or intimate relationships. And what happens is we take these schemas along with us for the ride. And what that can mean if we have these early maladaptive schemas is that we end up engaging in relationships with self and others in ways that can be unhelpful to us. Now, that's a very brief descriptor, but one of the core elements of schema therapy is that it's based on this premise of unmet need. And so I know that you talk a lot about attachment on your podcast, Louise, and attachment for me is one of the core unmet needs of the clients that I work with on a daily basis. So understanding your schemas can help you attach in a way that is more healthy, more helpful, and ultimately have you living a life that is more aligned to what you actually need.
That's why I love schema therapy, because people are listening and they're realizing, oh yeah, I have these patterns in adulthood that just keep repeating. Then they go on the journey and they realize, oh, they didn't start in adulthood. They started in childhood. And that's basically what schema therapy is. You had needs in childhood that didn't get met, and it developed these things called maladaptive schemas. And it's almost the connective piece between the unmet needs and the unhealthy patterns. So I feel like that's the perfect way to intro this episode, is to understand what a schema is, how it develops, and how many there are. Obviously, we can't go through all of them. There are lots of them, like abandonment, mistrust and abuse, emotional deprivation, shame, social isolation, dependence, vulnerability. I could go on. I'm not going to. We could literally do an episode on every schema. Maybe one day we will. But what we are here to talk about today is schema chemistry. And you got to understand what a schema is to be able to understand what schema chemistry is. So I guess let's just start with, what is schema chemistry?
So I very much view schema chemistry as like the interplay between your personal schemas and the schemas of someone else. So what we sometimes find is that people will gravitate towards and be attracted to people who have either very similar schemas to ours, so they mirror us in that regard, or schemas that fit with ours, okay? So for example, you were mentioning people who perhaps have an abandonment schema. And so it's really common for those who have struggled with abandonment through their life experiences up to this point to then be attracted to people who in some way are either unavailable, emotionally inconsistent, or just generally not present. And what happens is, because we have that unmet need of secure attachment, we behave in ways that perhaps are difficult and challenging for the person at the other end of that to sit with and stay with. And so in this really interesting way, we're self-sabotaging and creating exactly the situation that we really want to avoid. And it's so difficult for people when you point that out to them and the penny finally drops, because they're like, oh my God, now I understand that actually it's the abandonment schema that's pushing me to pick these people and creating the situation for myself that I really don't want in my life.
Oh, yes. And we've done two episodes on the abandonment wound. And we also have a 50-page guide on this, which is literally based on schema therapy. So if you guys want to go into that abandonment wound, head over to those episodes. Today, I was thinking maybe we would pick something else that we haven't spoken about recently on the podcast. I think emotional deprivation is a really interesting one, because I think all the time we have people saying, I had a good childhood. I wasn't abused. I wasn't neglected. I wasn't abandoned. So why do I struggle so much in my adult romantic relationships? Why can't it be easy?
Emotional deprivation is something that I think is pervasive in a way that we don't actually understand fully. And I do a lot of work on trauma. I do a lot of workshops on trauma. And when you ask people, do you believe that you've had an experience of trauma in your life? Many, many people will say no, because society views trauma as these very extreme events that happen to us, either type 2 traumas or type 1 traumas. And what we fail to grasp is that there is a relational aspect to trauma that exists even in childhood caregiver relationships, which were also loving and supportive. So if we're thinking about emotional deprivation specifically, Louise, one of the things that I see often is that we view our parents as loving and supportive, but we fail to see when we were emotional or when we were crying or upset or whatever, that they perhaps in really subtle ways minimized or dismissed or denied that emotional experience that we were going through. And so as children, we learn to suppress that emotion, to bury that somewhere, and just to cope with that. And it's then very difficult for us to then express our emotions in a healthy adult way. So in schema, we talk about our healthy adult, because we're constantly reverting to that pattern of the past. it feels familiar, it feels secure and safe. And so we just go back to safety, which is, let's not talk about that. And so emotional deprivation is something that I think people really misunderstand, and something that I'm really keen for people to acknowledge and think about what they can do to help themselves around.
I couldn't agree more. I feel like the part of my journey that I'm on at the moment is looking into emotional repression, particularly as someone who has a chronic pain disorder. I've tried everything in the book and I ended up in therapy because of the new wave of research showing the connection between emotional repression and many disorders. And you're so right. I think that people don't understand the impact and the gravity of it. And a lot of the work I've been doing is even understanding that as a child, there were body language responses from parents around me when there were big emotional outbursts. So even though I don't remember being told, you know, I was also told, why are you so emotional? Like, you know, I was explicitly told that, but also I'm learning about how implicit it can be and how our body is constantly scanning the environment for threats, right? And it's always connecting the dots, even when our little inner child can't consciously remember that. Do you think that that's fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. And our brains as infants and as children are wired for connection. And so you're absolutely 100% correct. And I talk about this a lot, that the messaging doesn't always need to be explicit. It's often implicit. It's often nonverbal. It's often body language, right? And so Gabor Maté talks about this, that it's really difficult for people to acknowledge something that didn't happen, right? It's confusing when someone says to you, well, that potentially was traumatic. And it's the trauma that impacts on our conditioning and where the schemas start to develop from. And so, yeah, I think that is something that when people acknowledge that, it can be quite overwhelming because we think of it as like verbal or really abusive, and it's not often the case.
You are so right. I'm so happy you referenced Gabor Maté. He's literally one of my favorite practitioners, like generating a movement in helping us understand actually how much our childhoods shaped us. Let's take it back to the schema. So let's say someone's listening to this and they're like, hey, yeah, that's me actually. Like, I didn't have a lot of emotional attunement and support in my childhood. Let's take it into the three coping mechanisms. So the first one, surrender. So what would it look like if someone had the maladaptive schema of emotional deprivation and they surrendered to it? How would that show up in their romantic relationships?
So I guess if you think about that over time, usually when people get into relationships, they're a bit different in those first 6 months, right? So there's a lot of overcompensating going on so that we connect well with someone, right? So we're compensating for the things that we know are not quite helpful about how we relate and interact. And then at some point, let's say we get into a relationship with a partner who is not willing to sort of allow emotional expression, not encouraging emotional expression. And essentially, we're just going to abandon ourselves and not, when we're met with sort of resistance to that, we just give in. We simply give in. And it's easier to do that because that's what we know how to do. That's the model that we already have. And so it's much harder to then say, well, actually, there's something that doesn't feel right. How can I support myself to express those emotions, to seek emotional support from my partner? I'm just going to hold up my hands and say, I can't do this. So it's then a case of, do people stay in the relationships often, or something goes a bit awry and perhaps the relationship ends? But, you know, in schema, we often talk about not just surrender, but like helpless surrender. We throw our hands up and say, I'm helpless to do anything. And it's really absolves us of any responsibility. And I think if there's one thing that I want to say to people, it's this: you are responsible for looking after yourself as an adult. You weren't as a child, but as an adult, you need to think about, what need am I not meeting? How can I ask for that need to be met? And if that person is not able to show reciprocity and show equality in that, perhaps it's time to let that relationship go.
Yeah, because sometimes you have to do something you've never done to get an outcome that you've never had. And we talk about that all the time here. Your nervous system stays close to what is familiar, even if it's cycles of being abandoned, even if it's cycles of every partner cheats on me or every partner ends up being toxic and abusive. It's a very hard home truth that because of schema therapy, you are attracting and entertaining and engaging in those dynamics because your nervous system knows how to handle that. And that's why I love these topics of surrender, avoidance, and overcompensation, because it's like, if you're surrendering to the abandonment schema, you just pick people that constantly abandon you, people that can't commit to you. You're the other woman or the other man, or they leave, they have to go to a job in another country, or they don't want a long-term relationship right now. If you have the mistrust and abuse one, it's like you will always pick people that are angry. You will always pick people that take it out on you when they are angry. Or if you have the dependent schema, you will always end up like, I guess, like subjugating to the other person. They will make all the decisions, all of the financial decisions and all of the decisions just in life. So I think we're clear on surrender. Talk to me about avoidance. I feel like that one's quite clear. Just the pain of the unmet need in childhood was so painful that in adulthood, the person ultimately is just like, I'm just going to avoid this because it's going to hurt.
Absolutely. It's ultimately feels much safer and much more secure to just stay in the same lane, keep doing what you've always done, rather than doing that sort of healthy adult response and getting into really hard conversations. And so people avoid through all manner of things. And avoidance is something that I'm dealing with in therapy daily. And even avoidance of like understanding and awareness. When people get into therapy, they really avoid even engaging in the process of it. You were talking earlier about how schema has changed your life, but you have to be ready and willing to hear the messaging. I often get people feeling very guilty that they are somehow blaming their parents for their failings and flaws as an adult. And I'm kind of really at pains to say to those people, this is not a blame game, because blame does not promote responsibility taking. And if you're finding that that's how you're feeling, you might want to ask yourself, actually, what am I avoiding and why? Why is it so painful for me to acknowledge the patterns of the past? And it's usually because we love our parents. We don't want them to feel like we are pointing fingers. I don't know if that's something that you experience, Louise, but many, many of the clients that I work with sometimes stop at the point where we're even getting into schema because they're like, I just can't do it.
Yeah, I mean, my poor parents have been literally like hung out to dry on this podcast, and I always do it with love and respect and understanding that we are all just limited by our own childhoods and upbringings. And boy, boy, my parents have some difficult upbringings, like parents dying very early, parents going to prison. I mean, stuff that like I don't even really get into. So I have deep compassion for them, but it's really hard to have to say, you've hurt me and you've shaped me. And I think that that's why we suppress so much. We suppress the anger, we suppress the sadness, and we suppress the guilt, because it's just so painful to face up to. So I love it that we're talking about that. Another thing that I love about the avoidance response in schema therapy is we talk all the time on the podcast about the avoidant man, the avoidant woman. Everyone has been hurt by the avoidant man or woman. But schema therapy gives you more of an understanding into the avoidant individual. In schema therapy, you understand some people are avoiding abandonment. Some people are avoiding emotional deprivation. Some people are avoiding shame. It gives you such an insight into the avoidant individual, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that you're making that connection, because any relational-based therapy like schema, cognitive analytical therapy, all of those things are reciprocal. So what that allows you to do is not only create a blueprint for yourself around what are my schemas, what does that bring up for me, but when you meet new partners or when you are struggling in friendships or other relationships in your life, you can look to them and think what schemas are activated for them in this moment. And it gives you a bit of a sense of a roadmap through how you might navigate the conflict or whatever happens to be coming up for you. And that's why I love psychology and schema-based work so much, because it's applied. There's no point in just knowing a thing. It's about what you're going to do with knowledge, right?
I look back at all my relationships now as a result of schema therapy, and I'm like, oh, he had that schema. Mm-hmm. Oh, he surrendered to that schema. Mm-hmm. Oh, I had that schema. That's why I was attracted to his schema. Like, it literally, it sounds almost robotic, but that's why I'm obsessed with schema therapy, because it is very clear to identify what is going on for the most part with people. Let's talk about schema chemistry. That is why we are here. And I know that I'm not alone in that feeling of, I have met my soulmate. Before I went to therapy, this was something that I experienced all the time. I would literally meet someone, they'd even like smile at me or look at me, and I start to get to know them and I'd be like, that's it, this is it, like, oh my goodness. And that isn't even because I had the fairy tale dream. Like, I don't have that fairy tale dream of marriage and kids. That's not where it was coming from. It was just really coming from the fact that my body had such a physical reaction to how this person made me feel, that because of that feeling, I was like, well, this has to be something, right? Most people don't make me feel like this. So I'd love to understand how schema chemistry is playing a part in those initial hours, days, weeks, and I guess even months of connecting with someone and feeling like, oh my goodness.
So I think the early days of a relationship are so challenging because we feel so good. We are getting that dopamine hit of what it feels like to connect with someone. And I know that you talk a little bit about fantasy bonds on the podcast, but essentially that's like a defense mechanism that develops to help us to tolerate feelings that we have of disconnection. So again, that lack of security, that lack of safety. And so when we meet someone and we feel connected and we feel like, oh my God, this person just gets me, they understand who I am, it's actually a bit of a falsehood, right? Because they don't really know you intimately at that point. What's happening is you're so hungry, I guess, for that connection, that attachment, that feeling of security and safety, that you're not really attuned to what is going on. Your attunement's kind of gone out the window. And what happens when you're in that sort of falling in love state, you ignore things that are red flags. So I see that often in people in relationships, like red flag pops up and they knock it down again. And it's not until we're past the 6 month mark, maybe heading to the year mark. And that can often be a time where people are saying, oh my God, like, how did I not see this? Well, it was because you were in that dopamine induced fog around what it feels like to fall in love without actually really understanding who that person is and what their schema blueprint looks like and whether that actually fits with mine.
This is one of my favorite things ever. And every time we post about it, it goes so viral. Like, if you guys have experienced this, you are not alone. People literally being like, I cannot stop thinking about this person. It's like an addiction. Oh my goodness. But the truth is, it's like, you don't even know this person. You don't really know anything about them. Or even if you do, you haven't been in a relationship with them for many years. It's like this intense overwhelm at the beginning.
Just picking up on that, I think one of the things that we do when we meet a new partner is we're projecting our idealized version of who we believe we want onto that person. And that's a lot of pressure for a partner. And I think it's just something to be really aware of. What is it I think I want? And am I projecting that onto that person, or is it who they are?
Yeah, you are so right. Because it's like a fantasy of you, a fantasy of them, and a fantasy of the future. It's not grounded in reality. You're putting your best foot forward. So are they. You're not seeing each other's mess and pain and grief and loss and heartbreak and attachment trauma and all of these things. There is that moment where it's just like, this person's going to save everything. They're going to solve everything. You know, I have friends who honestly feel like all they need is a boyfriend and they will be happy. And I am like, it just doesn't work like that. Sure, they will bring you some connection and some contentment and some happiness and some passion and amazing things. But that fantasy doesn't always play out in reality as we expect. The reality starts to peek through. And in schema therapy, that's because both of your schemas start to come to the surface. I'd love it if you could talk to me about this concept of a schema trap, or I guess we could even call it a chemistry trap.
Well, I mean, I think ultimately what you're referring to is that moment in the relationship when you realize the projected or idealized version of you, them, what this relationship looks like. You get to that moment where you realize this isn't actually a true reflection of what's going on in this relationship, and the reality comes to the fore. And so the schema chemistry has essentially hooked you in to a situation that you're then left thinking, how did I get here? And so it's very difficult then, because often what people then do is they, depending on their own psychology and what they think about these things, well, I've made my bed and I'm just going to lie in it. Or, no, I know what to do. This is how we're going to work through this. But the partner might not be on board with that. So it's really about thinking, how can I not get dragged along with the schema chemistry? how can I really take a step back and sit from that place of healthy adult and really ask myself, is this meeting my need in a healthy way, or is it meeting an unmet need that is something that I need to meet for myself first before I then go out and try to find someone else to meet it for me?
Oh, yeah, that's so important about how are you using this person? What are they soothing within you? What pain are they taking away from you when you interact with them? What wound are they taking you away from? Or alternatively, in the surrender context, what wound are they repeatedly bringing to the surface because you just keep surrendering to that? I'd love to talk through some of the schemas that you see that connect together like a jigsaw for better or for worse. And I really think this is the part of the episode where people are going to be like, oh my goodness, that is me. Oh my goodness, that is what happened with an ex. Let's talk schema jigsaws. I just made that term up.
No, I love that. And I think the abandonment one is one that's very, very prevalent. But you'd also talked about mistrust abuse earlier. So this belief, for example, that other people are going to essentially abuse me, mistreat me, cheat on me, perhaps, in relationships. And again, it becomes self-perpetuating because you are going out into the world, you have this core belief that that's what people will do, that you mistrust others. And so you constantly pick partners that are then being mirrored to by you and those beliefs. And whether they were intending to cheat or not, or whether that's who they are as people, sometimes these become self-perpetuating cycles because we get very jealous, for example, if we have had experiences of being cheated on in the past. So we're hyper-vigilant and we're looking for it and we're talking about it and we're perhaps pushing our partner further and further away, leading them further down the pathway towards perhaps actually doing the thing that we're trying to avoid. So it's that way that no matter what the schema is, we're trying to guard against it, but we behave in ways that make it more likely. And so I think what happens in schema chemistry is we're drawn to these people in a way that is unhealthy. And we try to project all these, it's going to be great, it's going to be amazing. But actually, over time, it just compounds and becomes more problematic. Now, actually, I also want to say though, Louise, this all sounds like really sort of difficult and challenging. And actually, what I will say is when you can know your schema chemistry and know a partner's and you have a willingness together to learn and grow, it presents an absolutely beautiful opportunity, I think, to actually lay your cards on the table. And so I just feel like I want to say that it's not all doom and gloom if you're looking at your own relationship and thinking, oh God, like this is my schema, this is his, how does this fit together? You know, whatever it happens to be, there's some positivity in there.
I totally agree. And that's ultimately why we're both here, is it's not all doom and gloom. And sometimes we do focus on the challenges. And that's because identification of those is the first step to healing them and navigating them and talking about them and really revolutionizing like how you show up in love and intimacy. So I could not agree with you more. And like I said, since I started to learn about this, I was just like, oh, this makes so much sense and I can use it to my advantage. Let's talk about another schema trap that you see in practice. I personally thought that the self-sacrifice schema was really interesting. Now, it isn't one that I can relate to. I don't do a lot of self-sacrificing for those around me. If I'm totally honest, I'm like, I've got shit to do and I have to put myself first. But I look at my mum and she is the most self-sacrificing saint that I have ever seen. She works and cooks and cleans all day long. She is a martyr in the house, but she gets frustrated because people around her maybe don't do anything because she's taken on the self-sacrifice schema. I'd love your thoughts on maybe how that can show up in a romantic relationship and how someone might be listening to this thinking, oh my God, yes, I do everything for my partner and they don't do anything for me.
I love this one. And self-sacrificing as a schema is fairly similar to subjugation, but you use some interesting language around like you're sort of martyring yourself to the cause, right? You're meeting everyone's needs and you're doing going above and beyond. And meanwhile, all the things that you want for your life are going sort of unnoticed. And I think if we think about this in the context of romantic partnerships, and I don't want to genderize this too much, but often I work with women who are living with men who are like a son to them. They are doing their laundry and they're doing the majority of the cooking. Now, I know that is not the norm for everyone. I do understand that, but I do think that there are partnerships out there where someone takes on almost a parental role in that self-sacrificing. And what happens is, in that sort of schema chemistry relationship, you often find you've got one partner who's very self-sacrificing, martyring themselves to the cause, doing all the things, and the other partner who becomes quite entitled. You know, they believe that I don't need to do it. I deserve to have these things done for me. That's just a right, not a privilege. Da, da, da. And so that's a really toxic combination often. And it's one that I think does come off the back of children who potentially have had parents who will self-sacrifice, right? So they don't have to do things. And then they get into their adult life and they're looking for a partner who will be the self-sacrificer. So it's a common sort of combination that you will see.
Yeah. And to be totally honest, it's probably one of the combinations that I experience in my relationships. I definitely don't have the entitlement part of it, but I think it's so interesting what you say around like almost the attraction to the parental. Like my last two boyfriends, including my current boyfriend, who is just a dream, they are like my mum. They are incredible cooks. They are incredible homemakers. And I am like my dad. I work all the fucking time, excuse my language. And I have so much insane gratitude for my partner. I would not be able, I mean, I hardly even function as it is with how much I work, but without him, I really wouldn't be able to keep on top of my life. So yeah, I don't have that entitlement piece, but I can really see how that could play out in practice. I also can then see how frustrated you must get, because I see my mum, and sorry, I'm putting my parents on blast again. I see how frustrated my mum gets. She does everything. And then my dad just goes and plays golf. And she's like, where's my quality time from you? Like, look at all the things that I've done for you. Even if she doesn't explicitly say that. So as someone that's not a mum, as someone that doesn't have a family, I literally have the utmost respect for mothers. I do not know how you do it. I could not physically do being a mum and doing my business right now. Do you think that schema chemistry could help people communicate to their partner and say, hey, I'd love to talk to you about this. I've realized that this schema relates to me. And sometimes it shows up in our relationship like this, because sometimes I think people find it really hard to broach challenges or dynamics in their relationship. Maybe schema therapy could help with that.
Yeah, for sure. And as a mum, I'm a mum of five and a big blended family. So I...
Whoa!
Yeah, like I very much identify with this idea of sort of self-sacrificing and feeling quite resentful and running my own business. I want to spend more time on that. Yeah, I'm over here doing packed lunches and dinners and laundry. But I think one of the things, moving on to communication, I think obviously an awareness of your schema chemistry and of what's coming up for you is the first step. But if we're talking about communication, I think what happens more often than not is that self-sacrificers will just keep going and martyring and going and martyring until the point where they blow a fuse, right? That's what I see often as the pattern. And so it's often about not getting to that stage and being able to say, hey, we need to have a conversation in a calm, relaxed manner before we get to that point. And it's knowing yourself well enough to know before you are ready to blow that gasket.
Yeah, I love that. It's just awareness is so incredible. You really can start to understand your triggers and then be like, I have to remove myself from the room right now, because otherwise all hell is going to break loose when, you know, the trigger and the nervous system dysregulation comes to the surface. Now, the final thing that I love about schema is that it doesn't just relate to your romantic relationships. There's a lot of schema therapy that changed my life when I started to understand these deep feelings of defectiveness and shame that I held in my life and I held in my body, and that then I was constantly overcompensating against. So I'd love it if you could just tell me a little more about how you see that schema showing up. And is that something you see a lot in your day-to-day practice?
You're mentioning defectiveness shame and this idea that defectiveness is that I'm broken somehow, I'm not okay at my core. And I think I see a lot of this in clinical practice at quite extreme ends of the spectrum, actually. And often that can be driven by other sort of things like high expectations that perhaps our parents, we feel our parents have placed upon us. One of the biggest schemas I see with my client group is failure schema. So we're going about our day-to-day lives, and I think the proliferation of like social media and influencers and all that kind of stuff does drive some of this. But we have this idea that we're constantly striving towards a certain ideal, whether that's a certain body type or a career or achievements. And so we're comparing ourselves unfavorably to others all the time. And that drives all manner of things, low mood, low self-esteem. And when we're living with that low self-esteem, we're then trying to overcompensate and do certain things about that. But the coping mode that sort of overrides that more often than not is people get into this idea of being a perfectionistic over-controller. Now, that is me, I think. I definitely recognize that I am behaving in ways and doing things to achieve and strive more and more and more. And the problem with being perfectionistic is that it's never enough. So no matter how much we strive, no matter what we achieve, we're always like, what's next? And I think that's something that many, many of your listeners will perhaps relate to. And actually, part of what this is about in terms of treatment is understanding, well, how can I have compassion for that? And how can I let go of some of these ways that I'm holding myself to account all the time? Because it's exhausting, right?
Oh, you are not alone. And I really appreciate your vulnerability and openness. I really feel like whenever a therapist on the podcast or a doctor is open about their experience, the feedback is so positive. So thank you for being vulnerable with us. And I agree, I'm very open that my life is ruled by the unrelenting standards that is part of schema therapy. And it's just never enough. I can never do enough work to get to where I need to be, to find the right people around me. I always just feel like when I get there, I'll be able to take a break. When I get there, I'll be able to take a break. And then add in on top of that, like trying to keep up with friends, trying to do a long distance relationship, trying to stay healthy in the gym, trying to manage a chronic pain disorder, whatever it is. And I absolutely put pressure on myself that people from the outside like, you've just got to fucking stop. This is just too much. But I literally can't. What happens when you can't? You go to burnout. Is that something that you see with these perfectionistic overachievers as well?
Yeah, 100%. Perfectionism does two things to people. Either makes them keep striving more and more and more, or it paralyzes people. I talk about the perfectionistic procrastinator. So we just never move because we're too scared to fail. Or we've got the perfectionists who are a bit more open about, yeah, maybe it's not going to be perfect, but I'm striving towards that ideal all of the time. And I think you said earlier in the podcast, Louise, you were talking about like feeling happy, what happy is. And when we're talking about this within a schema context, happiness is a choice that people need to intentionally make every day. And if you are living in ways that are not conducive to your mental health and well-being, and that's not making you happy, well, it's about changing things now so that you're not at that burnout. You're not at that bit where you're kind of sobbing in a corner because it all just gets too much.
And I guess that's the perfect place to wrap up is we started the episode talking about how these are cycles on a record player that just repeat and repeat and repeat. And that is me. I have seen it in practice. I have broken so many cycles, predominantly in my romantic relationships, my attraction, my attachment. But that one piece is the perfectionism, the desire to achieve. I know it's tied to my dad, a very deep father wound that is just, if I can just make my father proud, then maybe he will communicate that love that I don't remember receiving in childhood. Sounds so simple, but like that is what it's about. And I know that he's proud of me. He loves me so much. But my inner child kind of hasn't yet been able to hold that because my nervous system is like wired to just keep going. So as we come to wrap up, I guess my question for you is, what advice would you give to someone who is exhausted by the cycles?
So it's interesting because I think many people get to this point in their late 20s, early 30s, and often there's a real profound sense of grief and loss for the life that could have been lived if you just let yourself off the hook. And so I think forgiveness and compassion is where you start. You ground yourself in that before you then start opening up what was the trauma, what were the patterns. But once you've done a bit of that work, thinking about building your psychological awareness, understanding what your schema patterns are, and then implementing behavioral change. So there's loads of ways. The people who are listening to your podcast are getting an education all the time, right? There's so much out there. But I would say go to some self-development reading. That is a really beautiful place to start if you can access one-to-one therapy initially. And yeah, just be compassionate with yourself. It's a hard road sometimes.
Oh, life is a hard road. It's also beautiful and amazing and sad and heartbreaking and full of joy and grace and fun. You know, what a journey that we are all here living together. And I'm just so grateful to have someone like you come on the podcast and share with so many different ways that we can start to journey and navigate. And to anyone listening, you're not alone. So thank you so much. This was an incredible episode. I loved it. Please tell us where everyone can find you on social media. Tell us about your podcast. We will link everything in the show notes as well, but I'd love to know.
Thank you so much, Louise. And it's been an absolute pleasure to come on and speak with you today. People can find me in all the usual places. So I'm on TikTok, Instagram at Dr. L.A. Williams, Facebook, and my podcast is called Know Your Own Psychology. So yeah, I'd love to connect with you wherever you get your socials.
Amazing. As I said, we'll link all of that in the show notes. And thank you so much.
Thanks, Louise.